Okay, item number 11, a briefing. Recent research from the Donnie E. Harmel, White-Tailed Deer Research Facility, Mr. Donnie Frales. Donnie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Commission, my name is Donnie Frales. I work for the Wildlife Division. I'm the project leader for the Edwards Plateau Ecosystems Management Project, area manager for the Kerr Wildlife Management Area. Today, I'd like to present to you the final results of a research project that was recently accepted and published into the Journal of Wildlife Management entitled Genetic and Environmental Interaction in White-Tailed Deer. This study was conducted at the Donnie Harmel White-Tailed Deer Research Facility, which is located there on the Kerr Wildlife Management Area. Very briefly, this is a pretty unique facility that we have. It was constructed in 1974, and since that time, we have been involved in a series of progressively complex research projects designed to investigate the effects of nutrition and genetics on antler development in white-tailed deer. The objective of this particular project was to determine if antler quality in white-tailed deer could be improved in subsequent cohorts by selecting for yearling males exhibiting superior antler potential. Previous projects had shown that yearling antler production was a good predictor of future antler potential. So in this particular project, we decided to use only yearling males, and that would minimize the effects of age on antler development. Since it is a pen deer study, we were able to completely control diet, which allowed for us to intensify the selection process, which I'll explain in a little further detail. Prior to the project, our biologists believed that there were really three groups of bucks in every deer herd based on antler size and available nutrition. It's kind of this, based on this common bell-shaped curve. On the far left of the curve is a few number of bucks that typically year in and year out produce lesser quality antlers regardless of available nutrition. They're kind of the worst of the worst. On the far right side of the bell-shaped curve is the opposite. There's a small group of bucks that produce superior antlers regardless of available nutrition. They're usually better than everybody else. And in the middle is a large group of deer that, for lack of a better term, we call swing deer, that are highly influenced by available nutrition. On the good years, their antlers are pretty good. On the poor years, their antlers generally are pretty poor. And the objective of this study was to see if those antlers on the see if those bucks on the very far right side of this bell-shaped curve actually exist, and could we select for those bucks, and would those traits be passed on to future generations? And the way that we decided to do this was to simulate a drought in the pens. Therefore, only those bucks on the far right would exhibit good antlers, and we could identify them using diet. And the way that we did that is we used a diet that was limited in quality and quantity. We gave them a half ration diet that was an 8% protein diet rather than normally what we give them is a 16% protein diet. The way we did that, we bring all these deer in this research facility into a central working area. In October, we wean those male fawns off of those does and place them into a separate pen and put them on this stress diet. So while they're growing that first set of antlers until they're a year and a half of age, this is all that they have to eat. We then bring them back through our deer pen facility, and we pick the ones that are exhibiting the most antler points, the top five or six, let's say, because it would depend on how many breeding pens we had that year. We would place that male into a single sire breeding pen where he could breed a group of unrelated does. Those does would become pregnant. They would have fawns. The following year, we would bring those deer back through our pens, wean the fawns from those does, place those male fawns on this stress diet and for them to grow their very first set of antlers. And we did this for eight generations, always using yearling males. the results of that project basically depicted in this slide here. You have birth year on the far left and our sample sizes on the far right. You see the number in the far right column is actually the number of males that survived to the yearling age class. We then subdivided that group into four categories based on number of antler points. For instance, out of that 27 born in 92, we had 9 spikes, 7 were 3 to 5 pointers, and 10 6 to 7 pointers, and only one had 8 or more points, which is kind of what you would expect When you have a bunch of yearling males on a low quality diet like that, you would expect to see a lot of spikes in lower quality antlers. Now remember what we did here is then we selected the 8-pointer and about 5 of the 6 or 7 pointers to be breeders, therefore effectively culling everything else out of the study. By the end of the study, 8 generations later, in that 99 cohort, you can see almost half of the males producing 8 or more points. And the following is just a series of slides depicting some common antler measurements. You have birth year along the bottom. The column represents the average for that yearling cohort that was born that year. The pictures are of yearling deer that were actually produced in this study. The number in the column is the sample size. That's the number of yearling bucks that we produced that were born that year. Antler weight is a good measure of antler mass. We simply cut the antlers off in October of each year and then weigh them. You can see in 92 we averaged about 100 grams of antlers on those yearling bucks. Now selecting for the best ones year after year, and that 99 cohort, those yearling bucks averaged 3 times the antler mass as those in 92. We basically had a 4-point deer herd, yearling buck deer herd in 92 on that poor diet. Selecting for the better ones, we improved that to the 99 cohort, averaged over 7 points per buck, 7 points for those yearling males born in that 99 cohort. Gross Boone and Crockett score is now widely accepted as a good unit of measure for deer antlers. It takes into consideration inside spread, main beam length, time length, and circumferences. We increased Gross Boone and Crockett score over 30 inches during the 8 years of this study. You can see that 92 cohort was fairly low. The 99 cohort, we averaged over 70 Gross Boone and Crockett points. Actually had 5 deer in that 99 cohort that averaged over 90, and we had 1 buck that scored over 105 on a half ration, half protein diet as a yearling. Now, if you have 8 years of drought, which is basically what we had in those pens, you would expect you would have a large number of spike antlered yearlings, which would actually increase throughout the study. But remember, we selected against that trait. So about a third of our yearling bucks were spike antlered at the beginning of the study, selecting against that trait, taking them out of the breeding population. We virtually eliminated spikes the last 3 years of the study. 97, 98, no spike antlered yearlings produced. In 99, we had 1 spike antlered yearling produced. That's a picture of him right there. Had we not had him, other than him, all the other deer in that particular cohort had 6 or more points as a yearling. The opposite was also true. You look at the trends in 8-point yearlings. This is kind of rare out there in the wild, but we significantly increased 8-point yearlings the last 4 years of the study. Whereas the last cohort, the 99 cohort, almost half of those averaged 8 or more points on a diet, a half ration diet with a 8% protein. Although not a part of the original study design, we found a strong correlation between live body weight and antler size. We increased live body weight 40 pounds during the 8 years of the project, even though these deer were being raised on a half ration, half protein diet. In conclusion, the phenotypic change of the way an animal looks in antler quality can be realized through an intensive selection process or a protection of yearling males which exhibit those superior antler traits. However, the genotype or the genetic makeup of these individuals can be masked by optimum nutritional conditions. If you remember those swing deer, they look pretty good on the years where habitat conditions are good. They tend to fall back when habitat conditions are bad, and they can slow your management results. So those are the deer that can cause you problem, but during periods of drought, those better quality yearlings can be identified. Now, this project provides further support to the fact that antler growth is genetically based and environmentally influenced. A deer has to have a genetic blueprint or a map that says he can produce large size antlers. If he gets adequate nutrition, he can meet that potential, but of course he can never exceed it. Our recommendations as biologists to landowners is to manage the habitat for the best available nutrition, remove those deer that are showing the lesser quality antlers to maintain that deer population at a level that the habitat can support, and then allow those bucks remaining to reach that genetic potential. Penn deer studies such as this have proven that antler traits are heritable and therefore selection will work. What is important for landowners to realize is this degree of success is directly related to the intensity of selection that you're able to place on the herd. And that's really what we don't have a handle on right now, is this level of intensity. Matter of fact, we're doing some studies right now in the field to try to identify those levels of where you can begin to see some satisfactory response. Selection based on yearling antler development can increase herd potential. So therefore, as biologists, we believe that recommendations and antler restrictions or regulations which offer protection to these lower quality males can effectively reduce your antler potential in a deer herd. And essentially, this is what happened with some of the southeastern states when they decided to implement some antler restrictions. They implemented like 4-point rules. You had to have 4 points on a side in order to be a legal buck. And what this did is shifted all of their hunting pressure to those better quality bucks while providing lifetime protection to those males that could not produce 8 or more points. We were fortunate when Texas implemented its antler restriction in some of the counties that we had the results of a project such as this to fall back on, and we put all of our hunting pressure on those lesser quality yearlings while providing protection to our better quality yearlings and allow the opportunity to harvest mature males. I believe you'll have a copy of the journal publication. The CD is one that we provide landowners during some of our landowner seminars there at the Kerr Wildlife Management Area. It has all of our ecosystems-based habitat management programs on there. The results of our deer research projects are on that CD. I'd like to thank you for your support of that deer research facility and the research projects on all of our wildlife management areas across the state. And I'll take any questions if there are any.
Any questions for Don? Dan and I were talking about it. It sounds like he's got something going maybe on his place as part of one of the research. But the doe side, you know, the obvious question.
Yes, sir. A common question. The doe carries 50% of the genetic material for antler development. So the males, of course, have a trait that you can see the antlers and make some judgments. But on the female side, how do you know which does are carrying the traits for big antlers? It's a very difficult thing to do. In this project, although it was originally designed to cull does out of the project also, we had pedigree records, and if a doe produced a spike, then we were going to take her out.
That's your criteria.
However, as it turned out, because we produced so few spikes towards the end of the study, we didn't actually cull very many does out of this project. This was really a male selection project right here, and provided some very surprising results in a short period of time. On a private ranch, what the recommendation that our biologists make is while you are keeping that deer population at the carrying capacity that the habitat can support, you turn over the deer herd, which basically means you kill some of your older age class deer, and you protect these better quality males so that you hope your future generations are then sired by those better quality males. Kill old does, bring in young does into the population. Hopefully their fathers are these better quality males that you've left. It's not a fast process. Deer management is a difficult thing, and as you folks know, I mean, put a lot of effort into it. But turning over that deer population is the key, and trying to get those females out there that are sired by your better quality males that you've left through the years.
On the doe, walk me through what your thought process is. Is there some way eventually this department can figure out a way so we can start looking at the doe side? Because my argument's always been is that we're only looking at 50%. You know, we're only looking at one half of the genetic makeup.
Yes.
And I understand there's no physical or visible way to tell a doe. So Commissioner Fregan was talking to me about the genome studies and how the cost has come down. Walk me through that. Is there something eventually maybe we can do there?
Well, it's... half-heartedly, we tell people that they ask, well, which doe do we shoot, and we tell them the one standing still is the one to shoot. And if you can shoot the other one, then shoot that one too. It's that population level that is the important thing to us as biologists right now. There's not a trait that I can tell you that you can look at a female deer and be able to say that she possesses good antler traits and she doesn't. It's not related to body size or anything like that. Not anything that we've ever seen.
I'm asking you going forward from a scientific point of view, would it?
Well, we will be able to, once they begin mapping additional mapping of the white-tailed deer genome. This is a very complicated process.
Right.
But antler traits are not controlled by a single gene or a single allele. It could be many. It could be 15, it could be 30. We don't know. And it may not have to be exactly what an antler trait does. It could be how they assimilate phosphorus or something like this could have some effect of antler development. It could be real complicated. But as we begin to map that genome, we will be able to identify those sites. From our perspective on the Kerr Wildlife Management Area, what we think is happening a lot of times is you have deer, both males and females, that are homozygous for big antler traits, and some that are heterozygous. If we all go back to our high school genetics, the big A, little A, let's just say a big A is a dominant antler trait and a little A is a small antler trait. Mm. And although they look the same, there may be heterozygous deer in that population which can have lots of small offspring. We've seen it, and in other people have too, where you have a doe that she just seems to have big offspring every single year. She's probably homozygous for big antler traits. Same thing for males and the sires. You have some that just throw out big males year after year after year. They're big A, big A's.
Yeah.
And some of them may look just like it, but they're big A, little A's. So it's kind of a simple, I'm not a geneticist, so that's kind of the way I understand it anyway.
Yeah.
It's a complicated thing, but there's a lot of work being done on that white-tailed genome.
There is a lot of work being done.
Texas A&M University has been real involved with our projects out there, and we've got DNA samples from all those. And matter of fact, I was just reading the other day about a grant that may be looking into the whitetail, applying for some money that may be looking into mapping that whitetail deer genome now. Pretty interesting stuff. We've come a long way with respect to that.
Yeah, good.
I just, for those of you who haven't visited the Kerr, I'd really encourage it. It's a great, it's very impressive to see what you guys have done out there, and I just want to compliment all of you. It's amazing. You want to go before they cut the antlers off. Take kids and go look at the deer, and it's
You cut them in October.
Good visit.
Yes, sir. We usually cut the antlers off in October, and we provide landowner seminars throughout the summer. Be glad to have folks out anytime.
And what next for the Kerr now? What are you working on?
Well, we're just wrapping up a study that looked at the effects of maternal stress on antler development in yearling bucks. Let's say a doe goes into a drought during that third trimester of pregnancy, what effect does that have on her male offspring? And we're just wrapping up that study right now. We've got another one that we're just finishing. We're looking at this homozygous and heterozygous thing. So,
good.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Donnie? Wonderful. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it is. Finally, maybe getting some of this figured out.